Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us here today. We start quickly with our day in history and what has happened in this day in history. This is some interesting births happened on this day. This is a day that a man named August Nathaniel Lushington was born on August 1st, 1869. He became the first African-American to earn a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine degree, earning that doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania. There are many firsts on this day. This is the day that Charles Clinton Spaulding was born, who created the most important black-owned business in America. When black folks could not get insurance, he created the North Carolina Mutual and Provident Association and became an important piece of black America and America. This was the day that Jeffrey Holder was born, and Trinidad, the actor. And this is also interesting enough, the day that Whitney Young in 1961 became executive director of the National Urban League, and Arthur Ashe on this day in 1964 became the first African-American to win the U.S. Davis, be on the U.S. Davis Cup, and to win Wimbledon. This is also the day that Adam Clayton Powell was elected congressman, the first African-American congressman from the East Coast of the United States in 1944 from Harlem, where a rebellion took place in Harlem against police brutality in 1943, just a year before. That was part of the spur that spurred Adam Clayton Powell to run and spurred his election to become a major leader in this country. In 1925, during segregation, of course, African-American lawyers could not join the American Bar Association. And on this day in 1925, the National Bar Association was formed in the United States. And also on this day, 1867, during Reconstruction, because black folks were given the right to vote for the first time in a state election in the South, the Republicans took over the state of Tennessee. Not the same Republican Party that might took over today. It's a very different Republican Party in 1867. This is also the day in 1834 that is celebrated as a holiday all throughout the Caribbean, that slavery was abolished in the British Empire. Not racism, but slavery was abolished in the British Empire. And in 1619, this is the day when the first Africans were brought as slaves to America in Jamestown, what became the United States of America. So this is actually over the next 4 or 5 years, we'll be talking a lot about this, but we'll end on that note today. And this day in history, August the 1st. We have us in the studio once again, retired Major Neil Franklin, who is Executive Director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's a 33-year police veteran who led the multi-jurisdictional anti-narcotics task forces, from Maryland State Police and ran the training department for the Baltimore City Police before he retired, and joins us in the studio once again. And Neil, good to see you. Welcome.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me back.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. And you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. Neil, before we went on the air, and we're going to cover kind of a range of issues here that have to do with police mentality, drug war, and where we are. And it's a very complex situation. I started off before we went on the air asking you about why it is you think that we that police forces, not just in Baltimore City, but across America, target African-American men. In ways that white men are not targeted, maybe in L.A. and in Tucson, other places. I know Mexican Americans are targeted outside the Reds. We're going to hear a commentary next week from a Native American writer about why they are in solidarity with what happened to Trayvon Martin, because it happens to them all the time in the towns that border their reservations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something in the mentality of this country, something in the mentality of our police departments that allows us kind of behavior against black men to take place.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting. You can go back in history, and there's always been somewhat of a conflict, a clash between police and young black men, and even older black men in many respects. And it's always been, you know, for different reasons. I think I was talking about when I was growing up in Baltimore City, the clash was different. It wasn't about the drug war. It was about what part of the city were we walking in. You know, and the police would, you know, move us along or out of that community where they felt we did not belong. But of the many times that I've been confronted by police in a negative way back in the 60s when I was growing up, it was never about drugs. It was never about being searched. They never searched me, you know. It was they treated me quite rudely, but as they did many others. But it was never about sitting us on a curb, searching us, halfway disrobing us in the middle of the street looking for drugs because the drug war wasn't in effect then. So there's always been a reason for this clash between police and young blacks. But today, you know, ever since we began the war on drugs, this drug war, I mean, it's just been heightened, and it takes on a much different picture. Just about every negative encounter between police and young blacks today centers around the drug trade, the drug war, looking for drugs, violating Fourth Amendment rights, how they're treated, whether we're talking a young man walking down the street or a traffic stop. Racial profiling sits squarely upon, today it sits squarely upon, the drug war and police trying to enforce this failed policy. And I asked the question, so what, you know, what would this policing thing look like with our young black men if we did not have this drug war, if drugs were not illegal, if we took an approach that we have done with alcohol and tobacco? I mean, so think about, and I want your listeners to think about all the interactions that they're familiar with between the police and young black men. So if that didn't exist, what would this picture look like? It'd be quite void, for one thing. It wouldn't be a whole lot of activity there.
So let me ask two questions here. Folks, I really do want you to join us at 410-319-8888, both about the issue of police mentality in our communities and what the Neil Franklin is positing as the head of law enforcement against prohibition, which is maybe we need to start thinking about the decriminalization or legalization of drugs as one of the, as a solution to the problems we face in our communities. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts as Neil Franklin joins us here on the air. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. But or two things. I mean, let me just go to the police issue and come and lead back right back to what you're talking about in terms of the prohibition against drugs in America and how that plays itself out. And we have one question coming in right now that I'll read that came through on the chat. But I described to you the show we did the other day about the death of Tyrone West who in police custody.
Yeah.
And the young man who witnesses, who lived in the community, who had graduated University of Maryland College Park, who was on his way to medical school, said he heard this man screaming for help, didn't know what was going on, ran up the alley, and saw the police surrounding a man on the ground, pummeling him with their fists and with their billy clubs. Then turned him over. He had handcuffs on because apparently he had stopped breathing and they were trying to give CPR. And then the other night, one of my producers sent me a video that was on television I hadn't seen of a young 13-year-old boy who was running from the police in a stolen car. And when they pulled him out, one police officer ran over and just went down and punched him and appeared to kick and punch him.
Yeah.
And he was already on the ground. He was already in custody. So the first question is, why is that essential to police behavior? Why does it feel like to most people that is, I mean, that was your life for 33 years, right? So what is it? Why does that take place?
Well, and I'll be honest with you, and this from a perspective of policing, you know, it is a dangerous job.
I don't know question
especially
about it.
Especially when you have to chase people. Okay, is the possibility of you being injured or severely injured is those percentages go up, you know. And I've chased people. I've caught people. And believe me, I've wanted to, you know, inflict a little pain or a little bit of harm. But you have to be reserved. You can't resort to that. But when you get into a policing environment where there's a lack of supervision, direct supervision and guidance and coaching, this is what you're going to end up with because this is just human instinct, really. I mean, you know, you're out there working, you have the authority, you think and believe people should respect that authority. And don't get me wrong, I know there's a lot to that. You have to earn that authority. It's not just bestowed upon you. Even though you do have a badge, you still have to earn it. But, you know, and then people in your mind violate that and cause you to chase them, putting your life in danger as well as others. And then when you catch that person, there's that urge, you know, to get the revenge, teach them a lesson. And the police do actually tell our young people that in the streets, you know, if you run from me, and when I catch you, as I will, you will get a beating. The problem here is, yes, you're going to have that urge. The problem here is being able to control that urge. And being a professional wearing that uniform, you should be able to do that. And those sergeants and those lieutenants out there should be ensuring that you can do that.
So on our way to talking about how the drug wars play into all this, let's go to the phones and read this chat that came in as well. 410-319-8888. Zeke, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's Keith.
I'm sorry, Keith. I'm sorry. It says Zeke on my screen. I apologize.
Yeah, that's all right. You know, I agree with what the guest first started out saying about the transition in terms of, I call it police harassment. And because I grew up during the same era that he came up in the 60s, et cetera. And have any of you ever read the book Charlie's Corner? It's a sociological study that was done years back of African American males and their socialization in terms of the community and gathering on corners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, though. Well, you know, this has this historical roots in it that goes all the way back to slavery. If we go back to slavery, men of color were not allowed to gather in groups. Think about that. They were perceived as a threat. They were perceived as about to create a riot or these kind of things. This goes way back to slavery. And just recently, you know, I just happened to be in White Marsh Mall. And I saw these group of white males. It was about maybe 10 or 15 of them. Mm-hmm. They were all walking down the road. And I was just saying to myself, I said, you know, look at that. There's no reaction. Society's not reacting to that. It's been considered, it's okay, they're white males. But if you saw a group of black males
right.
in the same situation, walking down the street, the police would be called. They would think that there must be a fight somewhere, there's going to be a riot. So this whole thing about policing of African-American male men of color, it's a historical thing that is rooted all the way back to slavery.
Well, Keith, I think,
and it has nothing to do with the drug epidemic. This is something that's a historical pattern.
Keith, I think you raised a very powerful issue here, and I do remember Tally's Corner.
Yeah.
It's a very important book.
But when combined with these, with the drug war, you know, when you combine that historical perspective that the caller is referring to with the drug war, then you just have a situation that is completely out of control. You know, again, we haven't had these conversations, these needed conversations about racism in this country. And, you know, I want to talk about a little bit of, you know, back in the 60s when me and my group of friends, we would gather on the corner. Okay, but this was in our neighborhood. We weren't walking in, as I said before, some neighborhood where the police thought we shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
In our own neighborhood, police would turn a corner, and I can tell you exactly where it was. We had our favorite place. Police would turn a corner at the top of Park Avenue coming down Newington and Reservoir Hill, and we had our favorite place sitting on this wall right there at the end of the alley. And the police would come down, and they'd stop. They'd wind the window down, and you know what? We knew every police officer that turned that corner. And we had a relationship with those police officers. Now, don't get me wrong. Those were the same police that would chase us from time to time when we did things we weren't supposed to do. But they didn't chase us off the corner. You know, many times we walk over to the car, have a brief conversation with the police officer. They wind the window up and they go on. That's not today. You know, typically today, when there's a group of young black males on the corner or sitting on a stoop somewhere, and it could be their very own stoop, not the stoop of a vacant home. Police have come down the street and many times use foul language at those young men, you know, sit them on a curb, search them, ask for ID, and do those things. And most of that, again, is because of these drug policies. You know, they're constantly looking for dope on people, constantly looking for dope on people. And because of the media and everything else that comes into play here, even at the fault of ourselves, you know, when you think about these laws in this country and mandatory minimum sentencing, it has been the black community who has been the champions behind many of this. You know, you go back into the 80s when we went through this whole crack phase thing and you know, with Lenny Bias and all of that and the aftermath of that. It was the black community, our black leaders going down to Capitol Hill into our state capitals, you know, calling for minimum mandatory sentencings and stronger policing. And here we are today. I mean, so it's not just, you know, policing. It's not just our, it's not just whites. It's all of us that have a role in this and that put us to where we are today with this situation.
That's good points. And let's go back to the phones here. And Bill at 410-319-8888, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning to you, guests. I just got your show a little bit. I didn't know the title of your guest. But anyhow, he mentioned a last statement. He said if the policeman has to chase you, I guess the adrenaline rush, the policeman chasing the person, they're going to get a beating. And that's a little statement that he mentioned about a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's the same thing that happened with the Trayvon Martin case, because you're chasing this person. The police tells you to stand down, and you chase this person, you catch up with them. And, of course, you have words. Kids of today have words to tell you. It may not mean anything. It's just telling you to back off, and then you get into an altercation. Next thing you know, you have the upper hand. But had it been the other way around and Mr. Martin had a gun or a knife or something, it might have been a different situation. But one thing I want to know, if you are doing a citizen's arrest, is there a unwritten law or law saying that you have to read this person a Miranda rights saying, I'm arresting you because I saw you break into this man's car or I saw you knock this person down and rob them? That's what I'm saying. If the policeman says stand down and you step in as a citizen to do an arrest or I don't know if it's an arrest or a beating or whatever. Yep. Is there a law that says you have to read the Miranda rights to this person before you proceed?
Okay.
First of all, I just want to, and this is a good question. I just want to point out two things real quick. I want to make sure that people understand that Trayvon Martin was not committing any crimes or even appearing to commit any crimes, and that, you know, Zimmerman was not an extension of law enforcement. He was not law enforcement. He was just someone who, in my opinion, from the facts I know, wanted to be the hero and bit off a little bit more than he can chew when he actually ended up face-to-face with Trayvon Martin, and you know, which resulted in Trayvon's death. As it relates to making a citizen's arrest for a citizen that witnesses a crime and then they latch on to someone to hold them for the police, merely that is all they are doing. They are restraining that person and holding that person until the police arrive. And, you know, in the Trayvon Martin situation, there was no reason or for Zimmerman to think that he could affect any type of citizen's arrest because there's nothing there to indicate that Trayvon was violating any law. And we know as a fact he was not. But no, there's no requirement to read rights. Citizens, you know, don't know that. They don't have that responsibility. And you got to be very careful when you're making a citizen's arrest. And I suggest that anybody that's thinking of taking on this role, I suggest that you have a conversation with your local police department first about how and when and what you should do.
A question came in here from Bobby. Should heroin be legalized?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that no drug should be prohibited. It's all about the regulation and control for that drug. There are countries like in Switzerland where they have heroin maintenance clinics. You talk to addicts, and methadone is not something that they advocate for. If you can provide pharmaceutical-grade, good-quality heroin to addicts where they know what the potency level is and know that it's not tainted with anything that will harm them, because it's usually the cutting agents that are more dangerous than the drug by far. But in Switzerland, where they have heroin maintenance clinics where addicts can go into this medical facility, they administer the heroin under medical supervision. They have absolutely zero overdose death rates. These people are no longer challenged with finding the money to finance their addictions, so they're not out robbing and stealing from people breaking in homes. They no longer have to lie to their family members. They can live with their family members, and many of them have gainful employment. So the crime rate has dropped dramatically, and these people are welcome back into society and are no longer shunned from society. They're treated like someone who has an alcohol addiction. So there are many ways that you can bring heroin out from underneath of this prohibition umbrella and deal with it from a health perspective, and that's where it should be.
So, and there's a follow-up here with that. It says, what about the social effects, particularly on families, but how do they function with a habit?
Yeah, well, see, the main problem here is not the fact that someone is addicted to heroin. It is that chaotic lifestyle that they have in trying to get the drug that they need. And, you know, and for the vast majority of heroin addicts, which is, and let me say, a very, very small percentage of those who actually use heroin who are really addicted. And it's the same with all other drugs. You know, the problem is that chaotic lifestyle, you know, of trying. It's not about getting high anymore. It's about not getting sick from missing a dose. So, you know, they're going to do whatever they need to do to get the drug so that they don't become sick. So if we have a healthcare model system maintenance program in place to deal with this, then that chaotic lifestyle disappears and their life becomes manageable. And when that happens, the relationship and with the family situation becomes manageable.
And that's in some ways why you just can't decriminalize it on a local level, because it doesn't take the crime or the violence or the dealing.
Decriminalization, and so people know the difference here. To decriminalize any drug, it's still going to be illegal to transport, to sell, to manufacture. You're still going to have the gangs on the street corners. They're going to be fighting each other for the corners and for the market share. And it's still going to be a dangerous product to use. But if you regulate it and control it along the lines that I just mentioned, it's what's being done in some other countries, then you can diminish the drug trade and bring it down to a level where it's pretty much non-existent, and then you don't have the spill-off crime from those who are addicted, trying to, you know, live in that chaotic lifestyle, trying to finance their addictions.
Let me go back to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Liz, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you can, Liz. Yes, we can.
All right. Well, I just had a comment. I was been listening since the start of the program, and I thought that regardless of the police war, or of the drug war, police are going to harass young black males anyway, and that all the drug war does is just give them another reason.
It gives them one huge reason.
One more reason. Yeah, and I feel that black males hate on their own enough as it is. Police officers, when they're trained in their position, the humanness of a black male goes out the window. I've seen black police, white police treat young black males like subhuman. And to watch that happen, where is that training, the training to just treat people like they're human, regardless of whether or not they're committing a crime? You know, it doesn't mean that they have to be treated like dirt.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And you know, as a former commander of the Baltimore Police Department's training division, I can tell you the training is superb. The training is good. They have pieces and a good portion of that training, number one, surrounds ethics. It also surrounds how you interact with the citizens of Baltimore. And there are components in place that actually, during that six-month training period, that put them in direct relationship with young people and homeless and so on. The problem is when they leave the academy walls. you know, and they get out there in the streets and they're working with a squad, and that squad says, you know what, you forget everything you learned in the academy. We're going to show you how to, you do it out on the street.
Right.
So there, you know, here we go. That's where the sergeants are important. That's where those squad leaders are important, and those lieutenants are important. And if they're not upholding what's being taught in the academy, that's a problem. And that's where the culture can, that's, you know, where the culture can, continues to breed, you know. But again, you know, this drug war, don't get me, you know, the police are put in a very difficult position here. You know, these officers who work in the street are put in a very difficult position. You know, when they're asked and told and directed to go out here and clear these corners and make these drug arrests, you know, and bring these numbers in, you know, and the citizens do call in. You know, we got these boys on the corner again. They're out here slinging this stuff. I can't get out my door. You know, I'm afraid to walk to the store. And so the police get the calls. They have to come in. Yes. And a lot of it is, you know, not resulting from a citizen's call, but just the police being directed to patrol certain neighborhoods and to deal with this so-called drug epidemic and drug dealing in our streets. And if they don't go out and perform and do that, they don't get promoted, they don't get good evaluations, they get chastised. So, you know, it's this catch-22. And many of these police officers don't want to have to do this. They don't want to be someone's parent, you know, in teaching someone or trying to educate someone on the potential harmful effects of drug use. You know, that's someone else's responsibility, family, church, and community.
Neil Franklin is a retired major, executive director of LEAP, the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a 33-year veteran of the police departments, both the state police and the Baltimore City Police. And it's always an honor and pleasure to have Neil in the studio. We'll make this a much more frequent visit. Neil, thank you so much.
Mark, thanks for having me.
Good to have
pleasure.
You here. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to have an update on the conviction and of Bradley Manning, what's taking place in that trial now from different perspectives. Stay with us. Don't go away.